From Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio.
And he goes, well, you know, if I release you, you could re-injure your shoulder and you got to be really careful. And I said, okay. So the next day I went to Nashville and I ran the marathon without training.
The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told in person in front of a live audience by the people who lived them at one of our ARC Stories events.
I don't know if you've had the experience of sitting between your mother and your 16-year-old boyfriend while Leonardo DiCaprio sketches Kate Winslet's breasts, but I have.
What caught my eye was there were flames shooting out of the TV set.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories about people overcoming challenges, both big and small, in some very unique ways.
And so I was like, I think that's what I'm gonna try to do, design a deck of playing cards.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up, after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded at a different event with a different theme. They include one about a man who risks everything to chase a dream, another where a young woman's relationship is interrupted by divine intervention, and a story about a man trying to get through one very hot night.
You know, one of the things I love most about what we get to do is we get to discover these unknown stories from people right here in Birmingham, and then we get to turn them around and let people hear these stories that they would have never otherwise heard.
Which is why I'm especially excited about this first story. It's about someone from right here in our backyard who overcomes a number of obstacles to get the chance to compete on an international stage. It was recorded at Urban Standard, and the theme for the night was "To the Victor Goes the Spoils," stories about competition. Here's storyteller Carrie Hill.
Back in 1999, in October, the boy I was dating at the time, we decided to train for a marathon. I never thought I could run a marathon. I wasn't really a big runner at the time. And I had never been out of the country. And so we decided to run the Dublin, Ireland marathon. And so I was so excited. I had been training for about 8 months, I guess, in advance. And we got there, and it was the most beautiful place ever. And the night before the race, my boyfriend broke up with me. I cried so hard. I had to be up at 7 a.m. at the start line, and I had cried all night. My face was all swollen. I was dehydrated, and here I was getting ready to do something without him. I left him in the dust. I finished an hour ahead of him, and I was so crushed, but at the same time, I was so mad, and I had so many emotions, and I was so emotional. I don't know if any of you have ever done that before, but it was like, I never thought I could do it, and I did it, and I came back home, and I should have been sad, but instead, I decided to sign up for more races. So I signed up for the Nashville Marathon. I even signed up for this thing called a duathlon, and it was the Alabama Power Man. I signed up for the Cheehaw Challenge, which was a 100-mile bike ride up to the top of Cheehaw. I signed up for all these races, and I said, okay, I pre-signed up because it was going to be cheaper, and it held me accountable. I had to actually do it. So I started training in March the next year. And my first time out training, I was with a friend named Matt, and we were out in Cook Springs, Alabama. It's really hilly out there, but it's really pretty. So we were riding, and all of a sudden, a group of dogs started coming after us. And so I'm like pedaling, and then it went black. Apparently, I had clipped his tire trying to get away from the dogs. He didn't realize I had gone down and hit my head, and he was still pedaling around. He turned around and looked and saw me in the ditch. So he came back, and he's trying to stabilize me, and I was unconscious. And the dogs started coming towards him, and they were basset hounds. And one got on his leg and started doing stuff. And but I don't know if you've ever been in a dream where somebody's chasing you and you're trying to scream and you can't scream, and you're like, ah. Well, that's how I felt. I felt like somebody was saying, "What's your name? What's your name?" And I was going, "Curry," and it was kind of coming out of the side of my mouth. So then they thought, "Oh gosh, she has a head injury here. My helmet was broken," and so they airlifted me to the hospital. I was in ICU for 3 days. I had a contusion on my brain, so they put a plate in. I had 7 screws in, and then it's like all that training, all those races, it just kind of came to a halt. And the doctor said, it's going to be about 6 months before you can start doing what you were doing again. And I was like, but I've got to train. I've got all these things. He goes, I had amnesia too. And I came home from the hospital, and I had the type of amnesia where I would forget like short-term memory. So my friend Matt would come over to visit me, and I said, hey, I got this great movie. It's called Sliding Doors. You want to watch it with me? He goes, okay, yeah, that sounds good. Next time, hey, I've got this awesome movie, Sliding Doors. You've got to see it. He watched that movie with me like 7 times. But I just keep forgetting. Well, I was out of work for about 3 weeks, and I got to see what real people do. I was like, what does everybody do for their life? I mean, I should be doing something more important with my life. Well, about a month later, I went back to the doctor, and I said, look, I've been really good. I haven't done anything. Can you please release me to do something? He goes, well, you know, if I release you, you got to be really careful. And I said, okay. So the next day, I went to Nashville, and I ran, walked the marathon without training, and I'm running, and I finished. And that same feeling of accomplishment came over me, and it was like such a rush, and I was like, oh, I'm going to ride up Cheehaw Mountain next week. So the next week, I grabbed my friend Matt, who was with me on the first accident, and a couple other friends, and we went to Cheehaw Mountain. This was my first time back on my bike. So we started in Piedmont, which was pretty flat until you get to the park, and then it starts getting really hilly. And most of my friends said, hey, I don't want to go to the top. And I said, I'm going to the top. I don't care if you go with me. So I had one friend go with me, and she went up with me. It was really hard, but I made it to the top of the mountain, and I felt like, $1 million, woo! Then the best was coming down the hill, and I was flying down the hill. I was like, oh, this is awesome. First time back on my bike, about 20 miles outside of this where we finish, a car came from behind, hit my friend Meredith. She goes flying. Car hits me. I go flying in the ditch. So the ambulance came, took me to the hospital, and I just had a bunch of road rash. So I was like, okay, that's not bad. So I didn't have to stay in the hospital, but I made sure I went to work the next day because I had all that time off. And I came in bandaged up, and they're like, what happened to you? And I said, oh, you won't believe it. I was hit by a car. And my boss says, that's a sign. You need to just stop. You don't need to be on the bike anymore. That's a sign. I said, well, but I love it. It's fine. I mean, what can happen to me now? I've had the dogs. I've been hit by a car. There's really nothing. Then I said, okay, I missed the Power Man because that was during the first accident. I did get the Nashville one in. That was good. I got the Cheehaw Challenge in, kind of. And I was like, well, I really want to do a duathlon because I've never done one before. So I looked online. When is the next duathlon around here? Well, there wasn't one, not till the next year. But I found one in Wisconsin. Minnesota. Sorry. It was Sartell, Minnesota. And it was in July. And I thought, okay, how can I get up there? I think I can get a plane ticket up there, but I'm going to have to send my bike up UPS because it's so expensive to fly with your bike. So I UPS'd it the week before, And I got there on a Friday, and the race was on a Saturday. And the guy I was staying with at the time, the bike never showed up at his house. And I had to have a bike for this race. And he said, well, let's take you to the bike shop. Maybe they rent bikes. And I said, yeah, let's just pray they do. So I went in there, and I said, hey, do y'all rent bikes? No, ma'am, we don't. I said, I just need a bike for this race. I came all the way from Alabama. And he said, this lady brought in her bike to get worked on. I'm sure if you don't wreck it, she might let you borrow it. And I said, okay, I'll take it. So he takes me back to the room and shows me this beautiful pink Schwinn. It was old, and I've never shifted gears on the bike before. It's always been in the handlebars for me. So I was like, okay, yeah, I'll take this. And so I went to the race, and I was so scared I was going to wreck it. I kept it in the largest gear so I didn't have to change gears. And I finished the race, and I was so excited I didn't wreck it. I turned back the bike in. I came back home, and I felt pretty good. I was like, I did a duathlon. I got a phone call. It was Tim Yount, who is the organizer of Team USA. And he said, Carrie Hill? And I said, yes, sir. And he goes, you just completed Sartell, Minnesota's duathlon. And I said, yes. And he said, well, congratulations. This was a qualifier race for Worlds in France, and you made it. And I said, hey, I had a pink Schwinn. You didn't? And there's, for real? And he said, yes. And congratulations. Welcome to the team. I hung up the phone. I ran back to my boss's desk, and I said, guess what? And she just looked at me like, what? And I said, you're not going to believe this. All that bad luck that I've had this year, I am going to France, and I am going to compete in the World Duathlon for Team USA. And she just said, well, you might want to call the corporate office because you took 3 weeks off this year already. And I just looked at her like, I cannot believe she's not happy for me. That's a sign for me. I turned around, went back to my desk, and I wrote out my 2 weeks' notice. I came back into her office, and I handed it to her, and she's like, what's this? I said, I'm going to France. And she goes, but what are you going to do for insurance? What are you going to do for a job? I said, I don't know, but I'm going to France. And I worked out my 2 weeks' notice. And during that time, all along, I had taught piano lessons on the side, just part-time here and there. And I had gotten a call from Samford University. And they said, we're looking for some piano teachers, and we heard about you. Would you be interested in coming and teaching here? And I said, would I? I would love to. But let me tell you, in October, there's a week that I won't be able to teach. I'm going to France. They're like, why are you going to France? I said, because I'm a part of Team USA. I'm going to be competing in the World Championship Duathlon. And they were so excited. It was perfect. It was exactly what I needed to hear. And so I started teaching full-time, and I've been teaching ever since, piano, because it's what I love to do. And I made it to France. The competition really wasn't about competing in France and trying to beat somebody, although I did one person. The competition was more about finding my life and finding my love and finding my passion and not letting people keep me down. I could have let my ex-boyfriend do that. I could have listened to the doctors. I could have listened to my boss. And I didn't. I won. Thanks.
Carrie Hill is a piano and accordion teacher You can find her on Twitter at Carrie Attune. That's C-A-R-R-I-E Attune.
Besides the fact that all of our stories are true and personal, our only other rules is that our storytellers don't use notes and they don't use props. But every now and then, we make an exception to that last rule. And Carrie's story is one of those exceptions. Right towards the end, she actually revealed her official Team USA jacket from a bag she had sitting beside her. And everyone loved it.
And I was one of them because, honestly, I kept expecting her to find out there was some kind of misunderstanding or something. I mean, after all, how many people do you know that accidentally end up on Team USA? But then she pulled out that jacket, and I was just so proud of Carrie and everything she had accomplished. I still remember it as one of my most favorite moments from any of our events.
It really is an inspiration how Carrie overcame that heartbreak in such a huge way. However, in our next story, it goes the other way. It's about the thing that causes the breakup itself. We'll have that story in just a moment. This is ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories.
This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true, personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live them. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories. We've all experienced the heartache that comes from a breakup. Sometimes, the severity of the heartache is determined not only by how much emotion we had tied up in the relationship, but also the reason that we're given that the relationship had to end. And in this next story, that reason is quite a doozy. It comes from an event we hosted earlier this year at the Avon Theater. The theme for the night was Love is a Battlefield, stories about love and heartache. Here's storyteller Aaron Moon.
So we all know that getting dumped is the worst part of love. I should know because I have been dumped in every iteration humanly possible. I've been cheated on and then dumped, which is reverse, as how it should be. I have been dumped because of 9/11. I have been dumped because of an altercation involving the attractiveness of Asian people. I've been dumped for being too aggressive on the intramural flag football field. I've been dumped for being too needy and a lot right now for a guy working at waiting tables at Outback. Been dumped via text, email, other people, other people's parents. The list could actually go on and on. But the worst dump you can ever be dumped upon is the first time you get dumped. Now, when my mother was pregnant with me, her water broke during the fourth stanza of I Surrender All at the First Baptist Church where I grew up. So I have been a good little Baptist girl ever since. I didn't know anything about other denominations. I had a couple of Methodist friends who were sprinkled when they were infants, and that was very exotic and kind of glamorous and possibly heretical. It was, I don't know. But I was a little impressionable cucumber that spent a lot of time pickling in Baptist juice. And I think we all know that there comes a time in a woman's life when she's 14 that she needs to rebel, and she feels the need to kind of break out of what her parents have set up for her. And I needed to get out of this Baptist sort of tyrannical, oppressive life that I was living in suburbia. But I have a good deal of, obviously, a lot of Baptist guilt. And I'm also a huge sufferer of firstborn people-pleasing. So rebelling was hard for me until I got into high school. And when I was a freshman in high school, I happened to be in a class with a bunch of upperclassmen. And there was a junior there. He was tall, dark hair, just kind of hipstery glasses before hipstery was cool. He was charming and funny, and the best part, he carried around a well-worn copy of Walden. It's like basically Jordan Catalano up in there. So obviously I thought he was the deal. His name was Chris, and he was a 16-year-old dreamboat. Chris was super charming, and for some reason, Chris liked me back. I have no idea why. I was 14. I didn't know anything about Thoreau. And also, my parents had a rule that I was not allowed to be an unaccompanied minor with a boy. Like, I had to be chaperoned. But Chris just took this in stride. This was like a man. He was a man, a 16-year-old man with a car. But he just kind of, like, was great with my parents' rules. And so, like, we started dating. But before we started dating, we were talking one day. It was a Friday. And he mentioned that he was going to go to church the next day. And I was like, nobody goes to church on a Saturday. Who goes to church on a Saturday? And maybe I didn't know a lot about Thoreau. But I could suss out some context clues. And through a good deal of library searching, I figured it out. He was Catholic. And it was as if he transformed into an exotic bird of paradise right in front of me. Oh my gosh, sweet lady of high school revelation, he's Catholic. This is the most rebellious thing I could possibly do. These people cross themselves. They pray to Mary. There's infant baptism going on there. He went to a Catholic church that had yearly German sausage festivals. So, like, this dude was super Catholic, and I, obviously, because what 14-year-old doesn't think Catholicism is super sexy, jumped on that. Chris and I started dating, and this was about the time that Titanic came out, and I really wanted to see Titanic. I really wanted to see Titanic, because one, what's more romantic than the sinking of the Titanic? Catholicism, obviously. But other than that, Leonardo DiCaprio is in it. And ladies, we all know, we know about the wonder that is Leo, early Leo. And two, Celine Dion sang the hell out of that theme song. And three, it was PG-13, so we knew there was going to be a little bit of nudity in it. And that sounds great for a 14-year-old. So I begged my mom, I begged her, please let me go see Titanic with Chris, please let me go. And she was like, yeah, sure, we can all go together. So I don't know if you've had the experience of sitting between your mother and your 16-year-old boyfriend while Leonardo DiCaprio sketches Kate Winslet's breasts. But I have, and it's as traumatic as you might imagine that it is. But I really thought that Titanic was going to be the thing that kind of crystallized our relationship in Chris's eyes. I really thought that by the end of it, he was going to see that our love, similar to Jack and Rose's love, was going to bridge the divide between Baptists and Catholics, just like it did for the poor people and the rich people on Titanic. And that our subsequent marriage, obviously, was going to just, we were going to be held up as an example of love conquering all denominations. So after Titanic was over and we sat through that with my mom, we were driving home with my mom, and Chris is super introspective, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it worked. It totally worked. He's going to tell me that he loves me, that his life's not complete without me. And it became one of those moments where you start to become hyper aware of your surroundings, and you want to remember what you're wearing and what the air smells like. And he asked me when we got home, he looked at me with those big brown eyes and he said, can we talk? And I didn't know. I said, yes, of course we can. So excited. And we went out on my porch, and I'm trying to remember this moment, and he looks at me, and with great difficulty and feeling, he says, Aaron, I think God's calling me to be a priest. I'm completely ashamed by how long it took me to understand what he meant. It was pretty heart-wrenching. I really felt like I understood persecution at that moment. But joke's on me probably still, because Chris never actually became a priest. He's a bartender now. So with the first breakup I ever had, it started off that list that I read you in the beginning with young love and getting dumped for God. Thank you.
Far, wherever you are,
Erin Moon is a producer, an author, and she's one of our story coaches at ARC Stories. You can keep up with her on Twitter at Erin H. Moon.
We may all know what it's like when a relationship ends, but I doubt many of us have been told, I'm breaking up with you because of God.
That's true, but I think that's part of what makes up our best stories. They're so specific to the teller, but they're also something we can all relate to. The next story is a good example of that too. Most of us were pretty anxious about our first time, but our next storyteller has a few additional reasons to be nervous.
Yes, he does. And we want you to know that this story does mention sex, but there is nothing graphic whatsoever. It comes from an event we hosted at Urban Standard with a theme of spooked stories about fear. Here's storyteller Wade Kwan.
Every time I drive home, I drive around the front of the house, even though it's longer and I always have to park in the back. I drive around the front of the house to see if it's on fire. In the years that I've been stuck in this habit, my brain hasn't quite reasoned out why finding out that the house is on fire from the front is better than finding out it's on fire from the back. But I do this because fire has tried to kill me at home, not once, but twice in my life. The second time it happened was some years ago. I was living in an apartment in Homewood over the mountain. It was a third floor apartment, nothing special. And I remember it was a bitterly cold New Year's Eve. And I had decided that I was going to stay home and dodge the New Year's Eve curse. If you've been in and out of relationships and you go to New Year's Eve and you're not currently in one, you're kind of stuck in this countdown mode where you're waiting and you're counting the seconds to midnight to celebrate this happy new year by watching everyone kiss their beloved while you nurse some flat champagne and wait to drive home against some amateur drunk drivers. So I figured that by staying at home, I'd have a good time. My friend Mike was coming over. We'd play football on the PlayStation and just eat a lot of junk food. So that was my New Year's Eve. It was on one of the trips to the kitchen to get some beer, and I think it was like 10 till midnight. So we go into the kitchen, and I thought I sniffed just like a whiff of smoke, which was unusual because we hadn't been cooking, and when I looked out the window, all I saw was just the cold, clear, dark night. No smoke, no fire, nothing. We were eager to get back to the game we had paused, and I wasn't even sure I had smelled anything. But, you know, something was nagging at me, and so we said, we'll make a quick trip outside. We won't even put on our coats. We'll just go outside and check, and then we'll just go right back in. So we went outside my apartment. It's 25 degrees outside, and there was nothing. We walked downstairs to the ground, and there was nothing. We walked around the corner of the apartment building, and the side of the building was on fire. More specifically, 2 feet away from the exterior of the building, there was a gas main that had exploded and was erupting flames. The fire was climbing up the side of the building. I lived on the third floor. It's already consuming the first floor. It wouldn't be long before it hit the second and the third floor. So we leapt into action. Mike grabbed the fire extinguisher, raced back downstairs, ran directly to the fire, emptied the entire extinguisher in seconds. No impact. I had run and gotten my cordless phone, dialed 911, screamed for the fire department. We banged on every apartment door to let everyone know to evacuate the building immediately. And we were banging for a long time because no one was home, because it was New Year's Eve. Once we had knocked on all the doors and determined we were the only ones there and we had evacuated, we waited outside. It was the longest 10 minutes of my life waiting for the fire department. But they showed up and they quickly took care of things. They got the gas main shut off. They put out the fire. There was minimal damage to the building. We found out later that that first floor apartment wasn't even occupied at the time. We also found out from the fire chief that the fire had started because some jerk in the apartment complex had launched a bottle rocket, and in a one in a million shot, had hit the gas main and it had exploded. This jerk didn't bother to knock on our door to let us know we were about to burn to a crisp, nor had bothered to call the fire department. But we had been extremely lucky. I was lucky because I had chosen to stay home instead of go out. I was lucky that we had paused the game when we did. I was lucky that I thought I had smelled smoke. And I was lucky that we had bothered to go outside and check, not just outside, but all the way around the building. Had none of those things happened, had I actually gone out, the building might have just burned to the ground, since, of course, no one else was at home to notice the fire either. The only souvenir I had of that terrible, once again cursed New Year's Eve was a severe cold, because I had been standing outside for half an hour in 25-degree weather with no coat, and when I finally went to sleep in my dark apartment, there was no heat because the gas had been turned off. And that was the second time fire tried to kill me in my own home. The first time was also an eventful evening. I remember it because it was the night I lost my virginity. It was in the same apartment, the third floor apartment in Homewood, some years earlier. I'm what you would call a late bloomer. I met a girl, we'll call her Rebecca, and we went out and we hit it off immediately. We went out for drinks, and we eventually ended up back at my place. And so things escalate, and before they escalate too much, I interrupt and say, by the way, I'm a virgin. I don't know if she was shocked or charmed by that admission, but she probably suspected I was telling the truth because it doesn't seem like the kind of thing you admit randomly. We decided that we would wait. We would make it a special evening. And so we did wait for an entire week. But that week, I got a chance to clean up the apartment. I got dressed up. We went out for a special dinner. And then we went back to my place. And to set the mood, I'd gotten like a bag of those tea light candles and lit them and put them like on the table and on the nightstand. I even put one on the top of this broken down TV set in the bedroom. And so things escalated, and jumping ahead, we fell asleep in blissful slumber. But then around 2 a.m., I woke up. I noticed like a couple of the candles still hadn't burnt out. But what caught my eye was there were flames shooting out of the top of the TV set. Evidently, the tea light had burned almost out, but the bottom of the candle was so hot, it melted the top of the plastic cabinet of the TV set, dropping the candle through and setting the electrical wiring on fire. I leapt out of bed, unplugged the TV set, and started blowing for my life, trying to blow out this fire. So toxic smoke is starting to fill the bedroom, and fortunately for Rebecca and I managed to blow out the fire. It was then that she and I, still half naked, carried the TV set outside of my apartment so we wouldn't have to inhale any more smoke, and I was praying that the TV set would not somehow spontaneously reignite and kill us. After all of that excitement, we managed to fall back asleep. But I realized that for the one time that I had had sex premarital sex, God was punishing me. And that was the first time fire tried to kill me at home. When I drive home later this evening, I'll drive around the front, and the house, like thousands of times before, will not be on fire. But I take some comfort in this one fear. Among the handful of fears that I nurture, this is the one fear that is grounded in reality. God had given me the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time.
Wade Kwan is a writer, editor, journalist, and blogger. You can read some of his thoughts at wadeonbirmingham.com.
One tidbit about Wade's story is that most of the time when we take submissions for our events, we do a lot of follow-up with the story coaches, and that's a good way for us to figure out what the story is really about. It's a good way for us to know if we really want to use the story in our live events. But with Wade's story, he had already told a story before, and I got an email from him that said, "Fire has tried to kill me twice, and once was the night that I lost my virginity." And I knew that he was a great storyteller, and so with that line only, I was hooked. I mean, yes, you're telling it, be it rehearsal.
Sometimes you just know when a good story is staring you in the face, and I think that's the case with this next story, too. In fact, it's one that was so obvious to us that we actually asked him to tell it. It's all about taking a huge risk in order to pursue your dream. But the dream in this next story is definitely not what you're expecting. That story's just ahead. This is ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, true stories told by the people who live them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm the director of ARC Stories, Taylor Robinson. Everyone has a dream that they want to pursue, but very few people actually get the courage to chase after that dream. And I am so happy to say that that's not true for this next storyteller, who also happens to be my little brother. His story was recorded at Urban Standard, where the theme was Spark, Stories About Inspiration. Here's storyteller Jackson Robinson.
Most of my life, I've been a professional artist of some sort, mostly drawing pictures and trading those pictures for monies and taking care of my family doing that. And about 5 years ago, I was working at a small illustration studio, and within the course of about a month, I was laid off. I experienced the birth of my first daughter, named Claire, and in the lobby room of the delivery room, my father gave me the information that my mother had breast cancer. And so I had these three huge life-changing events all happen within about a month. And my wife, Becca, and I, we started thinking about our lives and thinking about what we wanted and where we wanted to be and what we wanted to do with our lives. I had to find another job. So I always wanted to work in the gaming industry. I was doing like illustrations for packaging and stuff like that, but I always wanted to work in the gaming industry. So I found a job in Los Angeles to be a concept artist at a gaming studio. Now, what a concept artist is games and movies, they all have creatures, environments, buildings, vehicles, all that kind of crazy stuff. And they have to have somebody that takes the ideas and draws them and makes them into something so that other artists can create the things that you see on the screen. So that's what I did. Sounds pretty fun, right? So I packed up my bag, sold half of our crap, sold our house, and we took our baby girl and Becca, my wife, and we moved across the country to Los Angeles. Now, renting a U-Haul and moving across the street to a new apartment, that's okay. Moving to California might as well be going to the surface of Mars. And someone from the South, that has a Southern belle for a wife, moving their family to Los Angeles was one of the major culture shocks I've ever had in my entire life. But when I got there, I started working at the game studio, and any kind of job in the entertainment industry is just hellish in terms of the hours. I was working 15-hour days, 6-7 days a week, all year round, and it was expensive in LA for our little tiny two-bedroom apartment that we rented there. And I just started getting eroded by the life that I was living. My daughter was growing up. I was missing all of these memories that my wife and my daughter Claire were creating, but I wasn't a part of it because I was always at work. And in that, in the span of about 3 years, we had another daughter named Scarlett. And with life happening, 3 years, two daughters, we accumulated all kinds of debt, probably about over $40,000 worth of debt just from being and being a family and living in Los Angeles. And I couldn't figure out why it was eroding my life and I knew that if this life kept up, it was going to destroy my friendship with my best friend. It was going to leave me with no memories of my daughters. And I sat down with Becca and I said, we have got to change something. We've got to change what we're doing. But because of our situation, we were in bondage because of the debt, because of most of the entertainment jobs are in Los Angeles. And we didn't know what to do. So the only thing that I knew to do was, okay, I'm working so hard at my job, and I'm working so hard to put somebody else's kid through private school. And I said, I have got to figure out a way that I can use my art for myself, and so that my art can become my job and my business, that it creates a sustainable life for my family where I could be with my family. And so the first step to get out of that rat race that we were in was I had to earn some extra money to get us out of debt, because it was expensive to move to Los Angeles, and it's going to be expensive to move back to the South where we wanted to be. So I started trying to think about ways that I could moonlight to earn extra income. And then I came across this thing called Kickstarter. If you don't know what Kickstarter is, it's basically a website that you put an idea on the table, and people from all over the world come to the website and say, I like that idea. I'm going to give this guy some money, and I'm going to get something in return and make this idea a reality. And that's what it was. So I was like, I could do something. I could do something on Kickstarter. So what did I do? I made a t-shirt and put it out there. And then 15 days later, project was successful. I raised my funding, and I earned $400. And I was like, okay, $400, that's good. It's better than nothing, but it's not going to get me $40,000 out of the hole so we can get out of here and so I can save my marriage. And my wife was like, you should do another Kickstarter, another t-shirt. I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do another t-shirt. So I designed a second t-shirt. So I put it out there. 15 days later, successful. $600. My wife goes, that's great, Jackson. It's great. But there was something there. I had to believe that I could do what I loved doing and make a living at it and support my family. Because anytime I tried something else, I knew that I was doing the wrong thing and I could not do it. My wife couldn't live with me. So I had to do art. So I tried to figure out a way that I could do a Kickstarter because it was working. So I did some research on all these different Kickstarters. And then I found this tiny little world of playing cards. And I saw some Kickstarters. And then I saw this one project that this designer had designed a playing card deck. And he raised $144,000. And I looked at that deck and I was like, I can make this deck. I can design these cards. And so I was like, I think that's what I'm going to try to do, design a deck of playing cards. So my brother and I, Taylor, we use the mighty interwebs a lot, like Google Hangouts and stuff like that, Skype. And we're always shooting back and forth ideas. And we're like, hey, I'm going to do some playing cards. You're going to do some what? Playing cards? What? And we're talking about ideas and themes and stuff like that. And then my brother goes, whoa, 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 whoa. You should do a deck of cards that looks like money. And I went, yes. Yes, I should do a deck of cards that look like money. And I knew at that moment that we had something. We had lightning in a bottle because nobody had ever done it before. But everybody knows what money is. So everybody can relate to it, right? Who can't relate to it? So I was like, this is it. So I set on my artist toiling path to design this deck of cards that looks like money. And I love that type of engraving art that's on money. And so I try to create this entire deck of cards using like the imagery, the portraits, and the artwork from money, but make it a playing card. But at the same time, I wanted to make it look as close to money as I could. So I had my Kickstarter ready, I had my designs ready, and I was ready to push the go button. Now, with this project, I had to raise a little under $8,000 to make this a reality. Now, this was much bigger than the semi-cool t-shirt that I had done previous months. So I was a little bit nervous, and I was like, maybe this could be it. So my project was 30 days long. I had gone from my 15-day t-shirt projects to my 30-day playing card project. It was big in scope. So I pushed go. I see a couple of people pledging for it, a couple of people backing me, see some money coming in. All right. And so my wife and I go to sleep. And we wake up the next morning, and it had raised the complete $8,000 by the time we woke up. Within one day of a 30-day project. And I look at my wife and say, all right? And by the end of the project, I was able to pay off all of my debt and put enough money into my savings so that we could move. So we were almost there. We were almost there. And so my wife looks at me and goes, you should do another playing card project. And I go, yes, yes, I should. So I start designing a second series of playing cards that looks like money. Why fix it if it's not broke, right? So I start designing the second deck of playing cards that looks like money. And it was much bigger. I was like, all right, I got this. Let's do something big because I'm competitive, right? And so I designed this twice as big of scope project with twice as much funding goal, $16,000, to make this happen. But it was a scary time because 3 days before I started the project, I quit my job. I went into my boss and I said, I quit. Because I knew that I couldn't stay there any longer. And if I was going to do this, I had to do it. So 3 days later, we're sitting at the computer to push go on the second project. And I knew that this was going to be a pivotal moment in my life. I was either going to save my marriage, save my relationship with my kids. And I pushed go. And then in 18 minutes, I raised $16,000 and got it successful. And I look at my wife and I go, we did it. We did it. And then I let the project finish. Before the project was even finished, my wife went back to Texas. And 2 days after the project was over, I moved back to Texas. And it takes a while for playing cards to be produced. And so by the time I was in Texas, the first playing cards from the first project arrived in Texas. And one of the things that I'm most proud about, these playing cards, these little pieces of paper absolutely changed my life. And this one says, for Claire. This one says, for Scarlett. And then the two other ones from my other projects say, for Rebecca, my wife, and then for Nanette, my mother. You got to know when to fold up, know when.
In addition to being my little brother, Jackson is an artist, and that's right, a luxury playing card designer. You can go check out some of his designs for yourself at kingswildproject.com.
I love that story for so many reasons, but one of them is because it reminds me of why we do ARC stories. I know that it is a dream of both of ours to be purveyors of good stories, especially here in Birmingham. And it's a lot of hard work, but I think I can speak for both of us when I say that it is worth it.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely worth it, especially when we get to share those stories with everyone out there. And that's why we do the radio show on WBHM, and that's why we do the live events. And speaking of those live events, we have several coming up over the course of this summer, and we'll actually be looking for storytellers for a few of them as well. So if you'd like to come to an ARC Stories event, or if you have a story that you want to tell, you can find all the information that you need on our website, arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to ARC Stories Radio. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon and Nate Dreger for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date with all of our events, and you can even submit your own story. After all, we're always asking, what's your story?